I'm Vermont Edition producer Daniela Fierro, popping in to say we've edited this podcast a little for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. The world we live in is complicated, messy. Often it can be terrifying. To help explain complex issues and emotions to our children, we adults often turn to books. Simple yet artful storytelling and evocative illustrations can illuminate the world for kids and bring them comfort. And let's be honest, they can help us adults too. Today on the show, I'm going to sit down with South Burlington children's book author and illustrator Jason Chin. He's won numerous prestigious awards for his work, and he has a new book out this spring. But first, we are at a pivotal moment in Vermont's legislative session. It just passed its halfway mark, also known as Crossover Day. This deadline determines which bills will make their way out of committee and possibly become law. Here to tell us more about what our elected officials have been working on since January is Peter Hirschfeld. He covers state government and the Vermont legislature for Vermont Public. Pete, thanks for being here.
Life happens to be messy and complicated in the state house too, Michaela.
Oh boy.
There's a nice through line here between the segments.
All right, we'll need a children's book about that. All right, so let's start with this big mid-year spending package that folks might have been reading about in local headlines recently. Just last week, Governor Phil Scott vetoed this spending package. Democrats are in the majority this year, but they don't have quite enough votes to override a gubernatorial veto. Very different situation from last year. The debate over this spending package seems to center on Vermont's motel housing program. Pete, what's the latest update here?
So you mentioned the motel program. That is the main sticking point in this debate. But there were other elements of the Democrats' proposal that Phil Scott was opposed to. He was concerned about some funding for new positions at the Human Rights Commission, at the Vermont Attorney General's appellate unit. He was concerned about $1.6 million in funding for municipalities who were affected by flooding last year. He was also concerned about $10 million in funding for the Vermont Housing and Conservation Board, which was going to use that money to jumpstart construction on some pretty popular affordable housing projects. The governor says it's not that these aren't worthy expenditures, but they need to be considered in the context of next year's budget. So what lawmakers said yesterday is, okay, Governor, we're going to give you just about everything you want. We're going to get rid of all these appropriations that you're opposed to. We back down, cede virtually all the ground, but we want one thing in exchange. We want assurances that no children, no pregnant women, and no disabled people will be evicted from their state-subsidized motel rooms when the current freeze on those exits lapses on April 1st. I talked to Phil Scott's spokeswoman this morning, and she said that the administration says this is a non-starter. Phil Scott thinks the motel program is a broken system, that it wastes state resources on a housing model that does not deliver great outcomes, and they're not going to bend.
Does he have another proposal?
You know, we're not at that phase right now. Okay. What's happening right now is the House Appropriations Committee is moving forward with the bill that Democrats offered to Phil Scott that he's not going to accept. It passed, but notably on a party line vote, which means that Republicans in the House and Senate are probably in lockstep still with Phil Scott on this issue, and we're going to see the same numbers problem for Democrats that they've run into with this first round.
So you mentioned that Democratic leadership was willing to give up funding for a number of programs that I think people on both sides of the aisle agree are very important, including affordable housing projects, and they sort of selected the motel housing program as the thing that they wanted to hang their hat on, say, this is the most important thing we really want to fund this year. Do you have a sense of why that has emerged as this number one issue for Democrats?
I think it's because we saw how this plays out when these expanded eligibility allowances expire. We saw what happens when that's allowed to happen last fall. And we saw families with children leaving motel rooms and going to places to camp. We saw people with severe medical needs who no longer had access to the basic domestic infrastructure that they need to survive, frankly, in some instances. They don't want to relive that in 2 weeks. They don't want to see April come and hear litanies of stories about people in dire circumstances suddenly camping in the woods. And so I think that's why it's such a salient issue for Democrats in this moment.
There's so much upheaval around budgets, not just at the state level, but the federal level as well. The Trump administration, of course, has been making these massive cuts to the federal workforce and to federal spending, including by cutting grants that it makes to states for a whole host of programs. How have you seen these seismic shifts going on at the federal level trickling down to the work happening at the Vermont State House?
You know, there's one really recent example that relates to this conversation about the crossover deadline that we're happening, and it's related to a bill that passed out of the House Agriculture Committee that allocates $2 million to a program called Vermonters Feeding Vermonters. And what this money would do is go to the Vermont Food Bank so that they can purchase local healthy food from Vermont farmers and then distribute that food to local food shelves and other organizations that are serving low-income Vermonters. There's a renewed focus on that bill because just last week we learned that the Trump administration is cutting $1.7 million from a federal program, a USDA program, that was supposed to help schools and food shelves purchase produce from local farmers. So this sort of almost becomes a dollar for dollar offset, right? If lawmakers do move forward with this proposal that is now pending in the House Appropriations Committee. But lawmakers are not going to be able to keep up with the pace of federal cuts that a lot of folks are expecting. And there's a sense in Montpelier that they're going to have to be very deliberate and very strategic about picking and choosing when they're going to use state funds to backfill programs, and that they're going to have to go through a triage process to figure out where is the most critical need and how can we prioritize funding so that we keep the most Vermonters possible insulated from whatever happens at the federal level. Medicaid is going to be a huge issue potentially. And so there are a lot of lawmakers who are reluctant to commit funds to anything right now until they have a more universal view of what exactly the budget picture is going to look like come May or June.
Mm. Yeah, I was going to ask you about Medicaid and the potential massive cuts to that federal program. Because like you're saying, Pete, it seems like these needs for state dollars to backfill federal programs, it's just going to keep coming up and coming up over the next couple months.
It is. And we heard the Scott administration say to lawmakers at the outset of this session, we'll do what we can, but we don't have the horsepower to replace everything. And we're hearing the same thing from Democratic lawmakers, frankly, that you just don't have the resources in the state context to make up for the enormous funding comparatively that's coming from the feds.
Yeah.
So it's going to be tricky and it's going to be painful.
Yeah. So cost of living has been a core issue here in Vermont this session and before it, of course. And it seems like that is one of the key reasons why the Clean Heat Standard is on the chopping block. It's a 2023 law that aims to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but could raise home heating costs for Vermonters. And it turned out to be this big political wedge in last year's election cycle. And some Republicans have been calling for its repeal. Other folks say it should simply be amended. Is there any update on the Clean Heat Standard?
Yeah, there is. Just last week, the Senate Committee on Natural Resources and Energy passed out a bill that would repeal the Clean Heat Standard. This is a committee that's chaired by a Democrat. This is a bill that's going to go to a floor in a Senate where there's a Democratic majority. And by all accounts, it's going to pass. So it's not just Republicans now who are saying the Clean Heat Standard is not the right direction for Vermont. This is Democratic lawmakers acknowledging that as well.
Because some Democrats lost their seats in the last election in part because of their support for clean heat, right?
They did. And I think there are a lot of Democrats who still think in principle this could be the right policy move for Vermont. Sure, you're going to see a short-term increase in fossil fuel prices. But what you're getting as a trade-off for that is helping Vermonters transition into cleaner energy solutions that are going to get them off fossil fuels and potentially save them money over the long term. The reality is that the politics don't work for Democrats on this right now, and so they're letting it go. It's become a casualty of this November election, where they lost a historic number of seats in Montpelier. What's unclear is what, if anything, is going to replace that policy. This was a sweeping proposal. It reduced emissions at scale. And it's unclear whether Democrats or the Republican administration, for that matter, are going to come up with anything to replace a policy that would allow them to meet these aggressive emissions reductions mandates that are enshrined in law, right? Vermont has a statutory requirement to meet certain emissions reductions mandates by 2030. That's the open question now. The other open question is, are they going to keep those emissions reductions mandates in place? Governor Phil Scott, House and Senate Republicans are calling on Democrats to repeal those mandates and replace them what they say is a smoother glide path toward more realistic requirements. But we haven't seen Democrats show their hand on that front yet. And so lots to come on that in the coming weeks, I think.
Well, while we're talking about clean energy solutions, let's talk electric vehicles for a moment here. Over the past couple of years, there have been a bunch of state and federal incentives for car buyers who were willing to make the change to electric. But of course, more electric cars means fewer people are paying a gas tax at the gas station. And that money is collected and goes toward road and infrastructure projects in the state. Now, I understand there's a bill in the state Senate that would fill that gap. What can you tell us about it?
So that bill is actually in the House right now.
Excuse me.
It's okay. It's hard to keep track of them all. And the House Transportation Committee hasn't done it yet, but poised to advance this legislation. And what it would do is set the stage for a new mileage-based user fee for all of the electric vehicles that are registered in Vermont. And right now, that represents close to 15% of the transportation fleet in the state. As you mentioned, the gas tax, one of the biggest sources of revenue for Vermont's transportation fund. Obviously, if people aren't buying gas, we're going to see a deterioration in that revenue stream. So this proposal, which we should mention, is something that Governor Phil Scott actually proposed to lawmakers. He wants to see them adopt this new fee. This bill asked the Agency of Transportation to come up with the system we would use to put this in place by July of 2026. And it would require another vote by the legislature next year in order to have this actually take effect next year. But it looks like there's general agreement in both chambers and in the administration that this is a direction Vermont needs to head down sooner than later in order to address some really pressing issues with transportation funding.
Okay, so there's this potential for this new fee. Pete, I want to play this clip from Governor Phil Scott that I want you to react to in the context of this conversation we're having.
Sure.
In total, across all funds, I'm proposing a $9 billion budget. It doesn't raise taxes or fees and invests to grow our economy, make Vermont more affordable, and protect the most vulnerable.
That was Phil Scott in his budget address earlier this year. He's saying his budget does not raise taxes or fees.
So if I'm going to defend the governor, this fee would not take effect until the next fiscal year.
Okay.
So when he says this $9 billion budget does not affect taxes or fees, technically that's true. But I think, Michaela, it does highlight the difficulty, even for fiscally conservative Republicans, not to, at certain moments, pursue policies that are going to result in fee increases. I mean, there are certain realities related to technology, like electric vehicles, that forces policymakers to evolve their revenue systems in ways that acknowledge that new reality. And this is one of those cases.
Mm. Well, Pete, other questions for you on that topic, but I know we got to move along because there's so much going on at the State House right now, including, as we mentioned earlier, a lot of conversation about the rising cost of health insurance. Healthcare premiums this year have gone up, and Vermonters have some of the highest health insurance costs of anywhere in the country. And Vermont Public has reported on how Blue Cross Vermont, which is the state's largest insurer, is on the verge of insolvency. How are lawmakers responding to that?
So they are taking incredibly seriously the threat of insolvency for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Vermont. I talked to Representative Alyssa Black. She is the Democratic chair of the House Healthcare Committee. She said if that insurance company goes under, it's going to leave 70,000 people in Vermont without access to even be able to buy health insurance. And she said if it goes into receivership, I'll quote here, our entire system of healthcare in this state will cease to exist, end quote. Oh. So they see this as an acute and existential threat to the healthcare system. In response, the House Healthcare Committee has passed a bill. Black calls it, she thinks it's the most important piece of legislation that made the crossover deadline, that tries to institute new safeguards for Blue Cross's security. And what it would do is authorize the Green Mountain Care Board to intervene if Blue Cross finds itself on the brink, if it hits some key metrics that show it's really on the verge of going insolvent. And it would allow the Green Mountain Care Board, this five-person regulatory board, to initiate some mid-year budgeting amendments that would force hospitals that meet certain benchmarks – the only one of those hospitals we should mention is UVM Medical Center force UVM Medical Center to accept lower reimbursement rates from Blue Cross. So functionally, Blue Cross would have less of an outlay to Vermont's largest hospital. And the idea is that could provide some short-term relief to whatever financial situation they find themselves in. UVMMC has some concerns about this bill, told me that they fear it could lead to some unintended harmful consequences. But it's something that lawmakers are taking very seriously and that I think we'll see get a vote on the House floor in relatively short order.
Wow. Well, speaking of upcoming votes, Pete, let's tackle one more meaty issue, the yield bill. It's a bill that sets statewide property tax rates for education by calculating the money that's needed to fund school budgets. There was a lot of back and forth last year on the yield bill because of the high property taxes. Are we expecting a showdown this year from lawmakers?
It remains to be seen.
Okay.
Michaela, I don't actually know what that yield bill is going to do. Governor Phil Scott talked about using that yield bill to buy down tax increases entirely for Vermonters next year, so that people would not see an increase in the statewide education property tax bill that they have to pay the state. House Committee on Ways and Means is going to vote that bill out tomorrow. We will find out then whether they're going to follow the governor's recommendation on that. You can expect a robust debate either way on the merits of either buying down next year's increases in their entirety or perhaps holding on to some reserves to offset whatever increases we might see next year.
Mm. All right. So we have the yield bill coming up. We have the budget bill. I'm guessing we're going to have some veto showdowns this year as well. Pete, you have a lot you're holding in your head right now. We're very thankful to you for it. Vermont Public State House reporter Pete Hirschfeld, thanks so much for the time.
Great to talk with you, Michaela.
If you can, close your eyes for just a minute and think about your favorite picture book, either from when you were a kid or maybe one you've read to your own kid or grandkid recently. What's the story about? Is there a main character or is it more abstract? Whatever book you're thinking of, I would bet money that you are not just thinking through the story arc, but also seeing the pictures in your mind's eye. Maybe it's Shel Silverstein's shaky black and white lines, or the saturated blues and greens and oranges and yellows of Clement Hurd's illustrations in Goodnight Moon. A great children's book needs great pictures. It's an art that our next guest has mastered. Jason Chin is the author and artist of numerous award-winning books for children. In 2022, he won the Caldecott Medal, the highest honor in children's book illustration, for his work on the book Watercress, written by Andrea Wong. And this year, he and the writer Lynn Brunell won the 2025 Robert F. Silbert Medal for the most distinguished informational book for children published last year. It's called Life After Whale. Jason Chin lives in South Burlington with his family, and he joins me now. Jason, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Oh, we are so glad to have you. And listeners, we're glad to have you as well. And throughout this hour, we would love to hear about some of your favorite children's book illustrations. Perhaps there's a book you've read to your children or grandchildren recently whose images stuck out to you and helped make the story shine. I think our guest, Jason Chin, might be able to provide some context about what it is exactly that makes certain children's book illustrations connect with us and our emotions so deeply. You can call in and tell us about it or ask questions at 800-639-2211 or send an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Jason, let's start with the news of your latest award. It's for this book that we have in between us right now called Life After Whale, The Amazing Ecosystem of a Whale Fall. How did you and the author, Lynn Brunell, first connect on this topic?
Well, Lynn wrote the text, and my editor acquired it, and so I received the manuscript from him. And when I read it, I was just fascinated. I mean, the topic was just so intriguing, and Lynn's writing is really infectious. She loves this. Well, she loves science, and it really comes through in this book. She just loves this topic, and you could feel it in the writing. But it also has a great story, and I think for informational books especially, it's really important to not just have the information, but to also have a great story. So those are the things that impressed me with the book when I first read it.
Yeah. So as you said, it's informational. It's a book with a whale at its center, but, you know, it's not a whale with a name or a personality or any other anthropomorphized characteristics. It's a real whale at the heart of it. And there's a couple elements of this book that I wondered if you saw them as challenges. As somebody who has no artistic talent, I was amazed by the way, for example, you painted underwater scenes. Of course, this book takes place entirely in the ocean, and the quality of the blues and the whites and the light shining through the water, it makes it feel like you're there. Was that something that you had to work on and practice for this book?
It is something I had to work on. I did a book years ago. I can't remember how many years, but maybe a decade ago, about coral reefs. So for that book, I learned to scuba dive and got a lot of practice painting light shining through the water and painting scenes underwater. So I drew on that experience. So I had that when I went into this book. But oceans in different parts of the world are different colors. In fact, I had a discussion with a friend of mine who did a book about the Sargasso Sea, and we compared notes on the different blues we used.
Huh.
I went to Monterey Bay, California, where this book takes place, or it takes place off the coast of California, to do a whale watch and get a sense of what the ocean there feels like. I didn't get in the water. It was a little cold, but... But that was important research for me.
Excuse me. Part of the book takes place at the bottom of the ocean. It follows a whale's life cycle, and the whale slowly sinks to the bottom of the ocean. What was it like illustrating those scenes that take place in the dark?
Yeah, so that was a challenge. Of course, if you were there and you didn't bring a flashlight with you, you wouldn't... you wouldn't see anything. It's completely dark down there. This is a mile deep in the ocean, so I had to take some artistic license and kind of falsely light the scene there.
Black page would not be that visually fly. Stimulating.
It would be totally accurate, but it wouldn't fly, right? I had to use my, my artistic skills to invent that, we'll put it that. I chose to try and spotlight it so it still feels dark. You don't see any background as if there's a spotlight just shining on the one thing that I was illustrating, the one part of the whale or the one animal or whatever. And so that was my approach.
As I just mentioned, this book includes the death of a whale. And on the page in which the author describes that death, it's just gorgeous. It almost brought me to tears, honestly. What have you learned through working on this book or perhaps other children's books about illustrating a topic like death for children? How do you go about doing that?
Right. Illustrating difficult topics like death is a challenge. I try to be honest. That's my number one, the place that I start, I should say. That's where I start. In this case, that just involved, researching whales and whale falls and dead whales and learning about that subject matter. Actually, that part of the book was one of the parts that really moved me. I mentioned story, and that's a pivotal moment in the story. And I think Lynn wrote that moment really beautifully.
She describes the whale's eye slowly closing, and you illustrate
right.
that as
well.
That's
what I picked up on. When I read that part, it affected me too. I felt, sadness and loss. And I envisioned this eye slowly closing. So that's how it's depicted in the book, with panels with the eye closing over, kind of like a comic book. Adding those panels in kind of slows it down, right? It's one page, but you kind of go across the page slower. And so that was my approach there. I think it's important to be, going back to the honesty, though, it's important to find a way to be honest with the reader, with the child reader, and also sensitive to their emotions.
Yeah. Have you learned that lesson through being a dad yourself? You have two kids.
Yeah, I guess so. That actually reminds me of a story that my brother told me about his daughter. I did a book called Watercress. I illustrated a book called Watercress, which you mentioned.
A little book you won the Caldecott Medal for.
Right.
Yep.
And in that book, a character dies, a child dies, which is a very heavy moment, much heavier than a whale dying. And I worked with the art director and the editor, and we came up with a way to depict this and to keep it subtle. And my brother told me a story afterwards that his daughter, who was younger, looked at that page, thought about it, considered it, and then moved on. She wasn't ready, I guess, or she didn't want to talk about it at that time. But later on, she was older, they did talk about it. It came up. So I think kids, when they encounter difficult things in books, have that opportunity to either address it or not, or address it in their own time. And that's a really important characteristic of reading and of books, because you do have control over whether you want to turn the page or close the book or deal with it in your own way, as opposed to a movie or, the movie depiction kind of gives it to you, and you have to you have to deal with it. You can't stop. You can't stop it, right?
Yeah.
So books are really important for children to be able to deal with difficult subject matter.
Mm. We're speaking with the award-winning children's book author and illustrator Jason Chin of South Burlington. If you are a fan of his work or have questions about what it takes to illustrate a children's book, call in at 800-639-2211 or email vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Jason, I won't spend this whole interview exclaiming to you about all of the fascinating things I learned about whales from this book, but like, please, everyone should read it because I was like gasping at my desk learning about these creatures.
Yeah.
But one other thing, while we're talking about death, one thing that I found fascinating in this book that you had to grapple with as the illustrator was how the body of a whale, once it sinks to the bottom of the ocean, becomes this ecosystem in and of itself for all of these little creepy crawly critters. Some of your illustrations, I will admit, it just shifted from being extremely beautiful to giving me the heebie-jeebies. There's a lot of little worms that are feasting.
Yeah.
What was it like drawing that part of the book?
So I made a decision. I don't know if that's the right word. I started thinking about the whale after it dies and sinks to the bottom and becomes a whale fall. I started thinking of the whale's body as a landscape because that's what it is for all the creatures that come to feed on it and live around it and get their energy from this decomposing whale. So it became landscape in my mind. And part of my job was to learn the whale anatomy and learn about the skeleton and the musculature and so forth. So while I was learning about all that anatomy, I started to become kind of desensitized to the whale and what I was painting. And there was a point where I was painting along and, you know, one painting might take 4-5 days to do. So I'm on day 3 and I'm painting, you know, some of gore, some of the flesh there, and it just struck me. I was like, "Oh my gosh, this is like really gory."
Yeah,
and it made me wonder, you know, who's gonna like this book? but of course, it's fascinating too. Kids love that stuff.
And yeah,
I like reading it to them and saying, "Okay, are you ready for the grossest animal I've ever heard of?" The hagfish.
Oh, the hagfish. That is going to haunt my dreams tonight. Thank you for that.
Yeah, right.
We have Margaret in St. Albans calling in now. Margaret, you're on the air. Go ahead.
My favorite children's author and illustrator is Jan Bratt, who's also from New England. There's just such detail in her artwork, and oftentimes she uses side panels to just add more details. And even as an adult, you can see certain little secret messages in that artwork. And it's just wonderful.
Mm. Well, thank you for highlighting her work for us, Margaret. Jan Bratt, the author of The Mitten and many other children's books. Jason, are you familiar with her work?
Of course I am. Jan Bratt is wonderful. And her work is so detailed and so lush. And side panels. I love side panels.
Very useful.
Very useful, especially in an informational book.
Yes.
You get to put more information in.
Speaking of informational books, your new book, Hurricane, is all about, surprise, surprise, hurricanes. It comes out in May, and it takes place on a barrier island off the coast of North Carolina. And that island was impacted by many hurricanes over the decades, including Hurricane Irene, which, of course, caused very heavy damage in Vermont in 2011. Is that what got you interested in this topic?
In part it was. It's a topic that, of course, it's very relevant. My editor and I had talked about it a little bit on and off for a while. But then when he brought it up, I guess 2 years ago, it seemed like this was the right project to do at the time. But yes, Hurricane Irene is my most direct experience with, or was my most direct experience with a tropical storm.
And one of the things I really appreciated reading this book was how it breaks down something that could be really terrifying into very manageable steps. Not just the science of a hurricane, but how a community and a family would prepare for it. Can you talk about that element?
Sure. Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons I wanted to make this book, because hurricanes can be very scary.
Yeah.
They are very dangerous. And so making a book for children about hurricanes and giving them that knowledge about the storm and about how people prepare can make it less scary. And so that's one of the important reasons I wanted to make the book. In the book, there are kind of three stories. There's the story of the hurricane. There's the story of the scientists and meteorologists and hurricane hunters that are helping forecast the hurricane. And then there's the story of the community who's preparing for the hurricane. And one of the themes that came up as I was doing research and writing the book was the importance of community, the importance of the meteorological community, the weather enterprise, which is a global community that's working every day, thousands of people around the world working to gather the data, make the weather models, and make the forecasts that then we can use to protect ourselves from, well, just to see if it's, you know, what the weather's going to be, but then in the case of severe weather, take the appropriate measures and precautions. And then there's the community of emergency managers and the community that, you know, in this case in Cape Hatteras, in the town, that's taking care of each other, both ahead of the storm and then afterwards when they're recovering. So it really does take everyone when you have severe weather like this. And that was one of the things that I wanted to get into the book.
Yeah. I really liked the numerous reminders about the importance of helping your neighbors in the event of a natural disaster, you know, from one woman calling another to see if she needs anything at the grocery store before the storm to a neighbor, I think, borrowing a chainsaw after the storm to help with some fallen tree branches. I can imagine that community-mindedness in the face of disaster is something that you witnessed firsthand in this region.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, my son and I went down to help someone muck out his basement last summer. When I went to Hatteras to talk to people on the island about their experience with hurricanes, it came up over and over again. Help your neighbors, help your neighbors, help your neighbors. And it was, you know, so it really impressed me. Mm. It really impressed me.
Did you spend a lot of time on Cape Hatteras as you were researching this book?
I did. I went to Hatteras a couple of times. In fact, a friend of mine here in Vermont used to live there, and which is why I started to become interested in it. She said, "Oh, you're doing a book on hurricanes. You got to go to Hatteras. They get hurricanes all the time." I visited the elementary school there, and the teachers and introduced me to members of the community and so forth. So it was really it was really good to talk to people that experience hurricanes regularly and get their – and I tried to get an authentic representation of their experience in this book.
Mm. Well, if you are a fan of Jason Chin's – one of his many books, including Life After Whale or Watercress, or you want to tell us about your favorite children's book author or illustrator, you can call in at 800-639-2211 or email vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Jason, you grew up in Lyme, New Hampshire, and your dad was a child psychologist and your mother was an art teacher. That seems like just the perfect pairing of two people to produce a children's book author and illustrator. Did they both end up influencing your work or career path?
Sure. Of course they did. They're my parents.
Yeah.
They, you know, growing up, I always had art supplies available. It was just something we had in the house. I would when I showed a real interest in it, they would give me sketchbooks and pencils and things for Christmas gifts or birthday gifts.
Yeah.
So it was always, that I always had that available. I think when I said I'd like to go to art school, my dad was very apprehensive. Maybe. So he could foresee all the potential pitfalls of that decision. But no, they were very supportive, and I owe everything to them.
Hmm.
But I also I did have an illustrator in my town, or we had an illustrator. Maybe I lived in her town. I should say that.
Who was that?
Her name was Trina Shart Hyman, and she was a Caldecott Award-winning children's book illustrator. She visited our school in Lyme, and later on, when I was in high school, I got to know her, and she became my mentor. And I guess after my parents, she's the reason that I became a children's book illustrator. Really, actually, when I told her I wanted to go to art school, she said, "What would you want to do that for?" So she saw the pitfalls too.
What did she teach you? What did she instill in you?
She wasn't so much a teacher. She didn't teach me illustration skills. What she did was look at my artwork with me and ask me questions about it. And she showed me that she was interested and that she believed in me. It was kind of an implicit message that, she would always ask me to bring her new work after I saw her, in a few months when you have some new things, you may bring it over. I'd love to see it. She showed me what the life of an illustrator might be like. Hmm. So I could see, what her life was like, what her work was like, or work day was like. And I decided, I'd like to pursue this. And she believes in me, so I could believe in myself. That was the most important thing.
For the book Watercress, which you won the Caldecott Medal for, it follows the story of this Chinese-American girl whose parents pick wild watercress from the roadside to prepare for dinner. And that seemingly simple act ends up connecting the girl back to her Chinese heritage. And for that book, you used both Western and Chinese brushes to illustrate it. And I'm curious if there are other tools or methods that you would like to try in the future, other ways of illustrating?
I'm always looking for new things to add or new techniques to try. In Hurricane, I did it with pen and ink and watercolor, which is kind of new for me. I hadn't done a whole book that way. It was a big challenge. It was a lot harder than
Why? What's hard about it? Well, I mean, everything looks hard about it to me, but for you.
I didn't have the experience with it, right? So it was new, and I would do a drawing, and maybe it didn't come out the way I had hoped. So I'd do it. There was a lot of repetition, doing things over and over again.
Okay.
Because I didn't have the experience with the materials going into it, but it had the look that I wanted for that book. I'm always keeping my eye out for new things to bring into the artwork, new ways to think about the artwork. I'm working on a book right now, and I'm looking at a lot of Andrew Wyeth watercolors. Interested in the way he painted watercolor.
Hmm. Well, Jason, I wanted to get your thoughts on some news about the broader world of children's literature.
Sure.
Last month, the picture book author Mac Barnett was named the Library of Congress's new ambassador for young people's literature. Hmm. And in this interview that he did on NPR after he was appointed, he said his focus in this position was going to be on picture books, which he said are often undervalued. And I want to read a quote from him here. He said, "I'm not offended because it's dismissing my work. It's because we're dismissing kids. And if we think that children's books are anything less than real literature, it's because we think kids are something less than real people. And if we believe they are real people, then they deserve good art. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's a great quote. 100%. Mac is great. And so I'm so glad that he's in this role. He's going to do a great job. I visited a school last week or the week before in the library and was talking about him and how excited she is to spread some of the things he's been talking about. So I think he's already having a positive influence. Mm. I agree. You know, I'm an artist that wants to. Art is about communication, right? And it is important to me. This is something I learned from Trina, actually. It's important to me to be honest and give it my all and make the book as good as it can be, because I think kids deserve the best that I can give them. And I think that's, you know, you ask any children's author, illustrator, they feel the same way. And treating, it's a form of respect, I guess, for the child reader, you know. It's really, really important, you know, not to talk down to them, you know, not to use my parent voice, to talk directly and honestly to the child. So that's what I hope to do.
Mm. Are you ever nervous to show your books to your kids in the fear that they might not like them?
Yeah. No, I don't know. I've gotten over that. They've gotten older, but they have their opinions. In fact, do you have kids?
Yeah, one. Okay.
So sometimes when I would read books to my son after the umpteenth time of reading that same book, or if there was a book that I got tired of, I might say, you know what, this book is starting to bore me. Mm-hmm. Let's try a different one.
Yep, been there.
This common experience. Well, I showed my new book to my son. I won't say which one, but I read it to him. And he paused and he looked at me and said, "Dad, is this a boring book?" So I was like, well, there's an honest reaction for you.
We try not to talk down to them, but they will certainly
they will give you their honest answer. And that's one of the best things about writing for kids. They are honest. And you know right away if you connected with them or if you missed. I love it. They're the best audience to write for.
Mm. Well, what a fascinating and multifaceted career you have built for yourself, Jason, and very excited about your new book, Hurricane, which comes out in May. Jason Chin is a Caldecott Award-winning illustrator, and he grew up in New Hampshire, lives in Vermont. Jason, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was great.